I have a confession to make. I love the movies. I read about them, I watch them, I critique them. I even had a bunch of movie reviews published in the early 80s. I'm not as obsessive as some, but I'm a good deal more obsessive than most. I jumped at the chance to speak about theology at the movies, but then I realized with a sinking heart that I would have to reveal this great love, which verges on mania, that I have for the art form, digital or analog, rotoscoped or all one continuous take, animated or live action or CGI. I love movies for their pounding soundtracks and their wistful leitmotifs, the energetic and subtle performances of the human chameleons, the polish and precision of the planning and the technology and the execution of a really great shot. The behind-the-scenes dramas, the tempestuous romances, and the epic legal battles. The way you can watch a really great movie 20 times and still find things to love. The way trashy movies from your childhood can cheer you up in a minute. The way a movie that's an all-ages, cross-cultural hit can make everyone feel, however temporarily, like we're all members of the same family. As Willa Cather remarked in a novel, there are only two or three human stories, and they go on repeating themselves as fiercely as if they had never happened before. There are a lot of lists of plot types, but to me there's only three. Human versus human, human versus self, human versus elements. There are story traditions without conflict. The Japanese in particular have perfected ways of making movies in which there's no struggle, just life and all of its pains, pleasures, and changes. They get called art films because nothing happens. Every time I hear somebody complain about the repetitiveness of modern movies, I have to laugh. Recycling plots and characters has been a feature of plays and entertainments for 2,500 years. While a conformity of explosions and cleavage has taken over big-budget movies, let us be thankful for the improvements in affordable cinema technology, which have allowed people like actor, writer, director, composer Shane Carruth to bring his visions to the screen with his science fiction movies Primer and Upstream Color. Highly recommended, but extremely challenging and sometimes very hard to watch. The drop in cost has allowed poor people and marginalized people to record and document and publicize their lives, as Kimberly Rivers Roberts did in the documentary about her, Katrina, called Trouble the Water, which I also highly recommend. It has allowed us to bring our imaginings to bear on photographs of the deep sea and the forest canopies and the vastness of outer space, and to tell new stories with new energy, a firmer grasp on what it is to be human, and less concern with commercial success. It's now possible to make a movie, a good movie, an interesting movie, for less than it costs to buy a car. My love of the movies comes from my parents. When I was little, my parents had a 16mm projector, and I watched Chaplin and the Keystone Cops and Laurel and Hardy in my basement. They had a sound projector, too, so I watched the Weavers sing their songs, including an incredibly young and slender Pete Seeger. I associated watching films with quality family bonding time. These days, I ask two things from movies. One is, can you take me somewhere I haven't been before so that I am removed from my normal concerns and brought into a world I could not have imagined? This demand for novelty is not just show me something new, but I wish to be told a compelling story by a confident and competent storyteller. Take me out of my comfort zone. Put me in a situation I would never find myself in, and walk with me in the characters. Avoid the cliches and the tropes and the bad habits of modern filmmaking. No explosions today, please. The other thing I ask is the very simple, tell me your truth. If I'm to fully live my values, I hope to spend more time asking myself how a particular film is going to bring more compassion, wisdom, and self-knowledge into my life. In documentaries, I want accuracy and accountability. In fiction, I want a story that can be told no other way. For films which seek to uplift, a clear call to action is part of the experience. Which is funny, because movies make you sit still for 2 hours. It's after the movie is over that the magic really starts. A good movie makes memories. Memories of sitting around the coffee shop after the show and arguing about what the point of the movie was with your friends. A good movie becomes part of your artistic vocabulary, part of the catchphrases and in-jokes in your family and friends. A good movie is made by people who understand that it's going to have an effect on your nervous system, and they won't make you pull out your handkerchief without a good reason. A good movie makes you think and feel and stretches you a little, shows you your mental quirks and your cognitive biases, and loves you anyway. How should we watch a movie? I want to be experiential, not prescriptive. It's like, how do we feel about it, not you shall watch this list of movies. Nobody wants to watch Old Yeller the week their dog dies, and nobody wants to watch My Big Fat Greek Wedding when they've just been jilted. I really don't want to tell you what to do, but I do want you to think about your movie-watching habits. Mine have changed quite a bit in the last 5 years. I watch many more documentaries, and I'm trying to watch movies that have unstuck themselves from the gender norms and racial profiling that pursued us out of the 20th century and into the 21st. What to do? One is to stop watching any movie you think's a waste of time. Turn it off. I frequently stop watching movies that I think are bunk, that are gory or sexist or trite or racist or boring. I've even walked out of movies I paid for. If we have but one wild and precious life, let's not watch crappy movies. Another challenge is to think of a movie not as a piece of entertainment, although it's that, but as a commentary on our culture. Dig a little deeper. What is it really saying about gender roles, about love, about violence, about authority, about the ages and stages of the characters? Whose voices are being heard and whose voices are on the cutting room floor? Whose interests are being served by the assumptions that underlie the plot and the characters? That can be a very uncomfortable question. What shape is your own humanity in at the end of the film? Some of you may already know about the Bechdel test, which was invented by Alison Bechdel as part of her amazing comic series, Dykes to Watch Out For. In it, a character says that in order for her to feel comfortable about watching a movie, there have to be at least 2 named female characters, and they have to have a conversation that doesn't revolve around the needs of a man. There are an amazing number of movies that do not pass this simple test, including a lot of movies I like. But that will just give you an idea of how